This week on Making Contact.
The people are in the streets because they need more. They need more money to live.
Fuerza porque.
We used force because this is an issue facing us and our children. When there was a strike or a blockade, we went up to participate.
Throughout the 1980s and 90s, Latin America implemented the globalization policies demanded by the U.S. But now these policies are coming under fire. On this special edition of Making Contact, we meet with social activists, government officials, and residents of the poorest barrios in Bolivia and Peru. It turns out that globalization, which was supposed to help alleviate poverty, has instead made a lot of people very angry. I'm Reese Ehrlich, independent producer, and your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Driving out of Bolivia's capital, La Paz, you hit a winding highway that leads to the airport and eventually Peru. But on the sloping hills just off the highway lies El Alto, a huge working-class city of 800,000 people. Twice a week, people flock here to the largest open-air market in the region. Stretching dozens of square blocks, the market provides everything from food to clothing to used cars. The cars are so cheap that everyone assumes they're stolen from neighboring countries. But outside this relatively prosperous commercial area are the dirt roads and adobe homes of El Alto's poor. It's here, among the indigenous Aymara, the street vendors, and blue-collar workers, that an anti-globalization movement has taken root. It's not a movement learned from books, but one that emerged instead from the country's harsh reality of poverty and struggle. Oscar Huanca is the elected president of one district in El Alto.
Absolutely no one is addressing the problems of poverty in El Alto. In the city of El Alto, 65% of the people are poor, 20% are indigent. The majority are unemployed or work as street vendors or in the open air market. They receive no help from the central government.
And it's not only the lack of help from the Bolivian government. Both Democratic and Republican administrations in Washington, the World Bank, and International Monetary Fund have pressured Bolivia to open its markets and privatize government companies. The results? Well, let's take a look. In the Alto Lima neighborhood, Alejandra Arteaga wears the traditional derby hat and wide pleated skirt of the indigenous Aymaras. Arteaga and her neighbors have no electricity, running water, or sewage connections. They say their living conditions have gotten worse in the past 10 years because people have had to leave the countryside due to lack of jobs and come to impoverished cities. In early March, protesters from El Alto brought the country to a near standstill by blocking the main highway in and out of La Paz, opposing what they consider to be Bolivia's exploitation by foreign oil and gas companies. Alejandra Arteaga explains why she protested.
We used force because this is an issue facing us and our children. When there was a strike or a blockade, we went up to participate.
The protesters, including national labor unions, peasants, and indigenous groups, argue that foreign companies like British Petroleum and Enron should pay 50% of their profits to the Bolivian government. They also want indigenous people to have veto power over how the companies explore for oil on their land. Both proposals are opposed by Bolivia's president, Carlos Mesa.
President Mesa doesn't defend the Bolivian people. He defends the interests of transnational corporations. That's why we mobilized in marches and road blockades. We need to elect another president.
Arteaga and her neighbors also have a more immediate grievance. 8 years ago, the World Bank encouraged the privatization of the municipal water company serving El Alto and La Paz. The $53 billion French corporation Suez Lyonnaise took over the water system and improved some services, but executives didn't think their profits were high enough. So in 2004, they raised rates in El Alto, setting off a firestorm of protest. Alto Lima resident Mario Larruta opens one of the metal boxes that cover the household water meters owned by Suez. Water and sewage pipes run to the houses, but the residents don't actually get any water. Residents say that in order to do so, they have to dig trenches in the streets for laying their own water pipes and are charged a $10 supervision fee by Suez in the process. But that's not all. They also have to pay Suez additional hookup fees totaling $450, about 8 times the typical monthly wage here. They complain that if they miss even one monthly payment, their water is cut off and they must pay yet another fee to Suez to reconnect. As a result, about 200,000 residents in all of El Alto, a quarter of the population, are without water or sewage. La Ruta says people here are very angry at Suez and its local subsidiary, Aguas Illimani.
Están cobrando muchos excesos.
Many people can't get service. It costs a lot. It's very bad for us. We have water, but not for the entire population. They're afraid of the cost, so people don't get it.
Alejandra Arteaga complains that Aguas Illimani has another peculiar way of making profits. It charges based on the number of people in the house, not the amount of water flowing through their meter.
No consumo mucho, entonces me cobra más caro el Aguas Illimani.
I don't consume very much water, but we're charged by the size of the family. We want to get a refund. It takes a lot of paperwork and receipts. We don't have time to go to their office. The old municipal water company was much better. Aguas Illimani costs a lot more.
In October 2004, residents of El Alto had had enough. So they blocked the highway and forced the government to cancel the contract with Suez. Pablo Solon, head of the policy group Solon Foundation, says the popular movements against Suez and for greater control of other resources, like hydrocarbons, are objectively part of the worldwide anti-globalization movement.
The people of El Alto went to a fight not because they are against globalization. They don't even understand that word. They went to the streets because they want water to drink, 200,000 persons. But in the reality, of course, their battle means that you have to change the rules that support, that guarantee the profits of these big transnational companies. In that way, you can see it as a part of an anti-globalization movement.
Bolivia has some of the largest natural gas deposits in all of Latin America. Solon says many Bolivians see today's controversy as part of a centuries-old conflict between the people who live here and those who want to exploit Bolivia's natural resources.
We have been a very rich country with silver. We were a country even that had cities much more bigger than London. Then we came to be a very rich country in tin. So now is the turn of the gas. And people say we cannot lose this opportunity because if we recover at least the 50% of this natural resource, we're going to have funds enough to pay for health, for education.
Of course, foreign oil companies oppose any effort to make them pay higher taxes and royalties. That would require renegotiating existing contracts, which the companies argue is illegal under international law. Francesco Zarate, a top advisor to the president, says Mesa agrees with some of their concerns.
The oil companies want a law that's practical. They're not just after big profits, they want to develop the country's resources. On this point, the government agrees with the oil companies. The country doesn't benefit by just getting a few more dollars in tribute. As a responsible country, we won't impose just any tax in any amount because there are levels that are insufferable.
President Mesa draws much of his support from Bolivia's wealthy and sections of the middle class. Rita del Solar owns a catering company and lives in a very upscale neighborhood in La Paz. Like many in her neighborhood, she strongly opposed the street blockades by the indigenous, peasant, and labor groups. She agrees that poverty is a serious problem in Bolivia, but she blames a few agitators for stirring people up.
The people are in the streets because they need more. They need more money to live. It's true that they earn a very small amount of money, and they really need more. And they, whenever a person comes and says that he's going to give them more in any kind of a way, they believe him and they go out.
Del Solar says Bolivia was destabilized 2 years ago when the social movement's strikes and highway blockades forced the resignation of the previous president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. She doesn't want to see that happen to President Mesa.
He represents a democracy now. If we change presidents every year, well, then where is the democracy? So he has to stay. When the time comes, then he is going to call and we'll have another president. And let's hope he's going to be as good as this one.
So he should finish his term.
Of course he should finish.
But it's not only the elite who support President Mesa and foreign investors. Some poor Bolivians worry that foreign companies could pull out of the country altogether. Vilma Mejia sells children's toys here at an open-air market in El Alto. As she cradles her year-old baby in her arms, Mejia says she supports the president's position on the hydrocarbon issue, in part because of the tactics of his opponents.
I think in Bolivia we've never had a president as good as him. These blockades of the highways weren't good because common people like us don't like conflicts. We're not used to these blockades. When you have these marches and blockades, the people go inside their houses. No one asks our opinions. I don't like it.
President Mesa seeks to maintain the support of people like Mejia, as well as international companies, mainly through media campaigns and radio addresses. Pablo Solon says Mesa wants to increase government revenues without undermining investor confidence.
He is not going to change the law in a way that the big transnational companies feel that they are losing their profits and that they are losing their power here in Bolivia. So he has assumed that he is going to support a law that is seen as something positive by the World Bank, the IMF, and the international community.
Privatizing basic services and granting concessions to multinational corporations so they will invest are two key components of globalization. The result is supposed to be better services and economic prosperity. During the 1990s, Bolivia followed the advice of the U.S. and World Bank to adopt such a model. Alvaro Garcia, a sociologist and well-known TV commentator, says the international institutions saw Bolivia as a vast laboratory.
The World Bank and IMF carried out experiments in Bolivia with their structural policies of relying on foreign exports. We were supposed to privatize everything, everything without exception. We're a country where the opening of borders and markets was greater than anywhere on the continent. The results were a catastrophe. Bolivia can't compete in a global market. You can't compete on the internet with one shovel and two burros.
We'll have more about resistance to globalization in Bolivia and Peru in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or to order cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. In the year 2000, a mass movement in Cochabamba, Bolivia, reversed the privatization of that city's water company, operated by the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco. More recently, angry residents of El Alto rebelled a number of times, demanding that the Suez Water Company pull out of their community. Bolivians are particularly angry at the World Bank, an institution which is supposed to help eradicate poverty in developing countries, but in fact pushes conservative capitalism that makes matters worse, according to Pablo Solon. He points out that a division of the World Bank owns 8% of the privatized water company, Aguas Illimani, a subsidiary of Suez.
You have a World Bank that is also part of the problem. I mean, the question here to the World Bank is, they knew what was happening. How can they give credits to a private company that makes such a profit with the poor people and with their necessity to water? Our proposal to the World Bank is, instead of giving those credits to a company that's going to make a profit of 13%, that's for sure, why don't you give the money to the state that the state is not going to make such a profit? The only answer that they have is, because the public sector has too many corruption. Okay, so help us to have a good government where there is no corruption.
The government of President Mesa argues that the World Bank has been very helpful to Bolivia. It's provided much-needed loans and helped establish a business climate favorable to foreign investment. But presidential adviser Francesco Zarate admits that perhaps the pendulum has swung too far toward the free market policies known as neoliberalism.
The commission that I head is looking critically at the whole process of privatization and the neoliberal changes. We want reforms, but we don't want to go back to the 80s. We need to apply the necessary corrections. The state isn't the only regulator in an economy that's imperfect and underdeveloped. We have drawn a line. The state should work in association with the private sector. It should not be an activist. After 10 years, the World Bank has admitted its errors, as did we, the government. We are on the correct road, for example, by creating public-private enterprises to help the economy of the country.
The Bolivian government now advocates such a public-private enterprise to resolve the problems of Aguas Illimani. Under the government's latest plan, Suez would continue to own part of a new company, but not make new investments. The government would also be a part owner, hence the term public-private. Pablo Solon says this new public-private company will be a disaster.
We think that this solution is even worse than what we had. Why? Because now we have a concession for 30 years. That means that after 30 years, in the year 2027, the contract is finished and everything comes back. If you make a public-private company, it's half private forever unless you buy it.
In other words, Suez gets permanent ownership without having to make any new investments. Pablo Mendoza, a vice president in one of El Alto's districts, also opposes the public-private enterprise concept.
I don't want to see the participation of Suez. They've done a lot of bad work in El Alto, ignoring the people. The people don't want the participation of a transnational company. We think there should be a municipal water system under control of the neighborhoods.
That's the sentiment of a lot of people in El Alto. Yet the World Bank and the Mesa administration continue negotiations with Suez. Solon explains why.
The problem here in Bolivia is that Bolivia depends very much on the money that comes from the World Bank. It depends even to pay the salaries of the administration, of the public administration. So what's the problem? The government feels itself very blackmailed because they say, if we go against what they are saying, we are not going to receive the $100 or $200 million that we need to pay the salaries. So we cannot say nothing in order to lose that support.
Neither the World Bank nor Suez Leonés in Bolivia would comment publicly on these issues. Back in the working-class city of El Alto, any mention of President Mesa and the World Bank draws anger. Mario Larruta says the schools are bad and medical care is hard to get. He wants oil and gas revenues to help the poor.
He promises and promises. President Mesa likes to talk, but he doesn't deliver. We support the bill passed by the House of Deputies that says 50% of the oil and gas profits have to go to the government. If we don't get it, we'll hold more strikes and highway blockades.
And El Alto District President Oscar Huanca says Bolivians understand that the world is interconnected, but they want their fair share.
Nosotros los bolivianos seríamos locos.
We Bolivians are not crazy. We're not opposed to all foreign companies. We're not opposed to globalization under all circumstances. They bring some benefits to the country, but the fruits must remain in Bolivia and serve Bolivia. The companies send the money back to their countries. That's the problem. That means more poverty and more misery in Bolivia.
Bolivia is hardly the only country in South America to experience widespread opposition to globalization. In Venezuela, a greater share of the government oil revenues is going to help the poor. In Argentina, the government paid off foreign bondholders 30 cents on the dollar to fine U.S. and World Bank recommendations. And in Peru, as we're about to find out, opposition to globalization takes yet another form. On the northern outskirts of Lima, the poor barrio of Huaycan clings to the side of a mountain. Community leader Juan Chafloque walks up a series of steep stone steps.
Residents built these steps into the mountains, and it goes back to our Incan roots. It is part of our culture.
Peasants from the countryside flood into Lima, a city of some 7.5 million, and build homes on the sides of arid mountains because there's no place else to go. In this section of Huaycan, they don't even have the most basic city services. In one of the ironies of globalization, however,
hola, hello.
There is good cell phone coverage, even if residents can't afford to actually buy a cell phone. That's symbolic of the impact of globalization on Peru and much of the third world. While advanced services such as cell phones become available for the elite and some in the middle class, basic services are unavailable for many working people.
Agua, ni luz, ni desagüe.
Right now, the high part of town doesn't have electricity, running water, or sewage. The problem here is when it rains. The water floods down the hill and swamps people's houses.
Like Bolivia, Peru has its own history of battles with globalization. In the 1990s, President Alberto Fujimori privatized many state-owned companies with the full backing of the U.S., once again proving that democracy and free market capitalism go hand in hand. Unfortunately, Fujimori then proceeded to violate Peru's constitution and install himself permanently in power in what was called a self-coup. He engaged in brutal repression, claiming to be fighting against terrorism, and today stands indicted of stealing tens of millions of dollars from government coffers. Juan Chafloque was part of the massive anti-Fujimori movement that eventually forced the dictator from power in 2001 and elected President Alejandro Toledo.
Bueno, el problema es el presidente Toledo que ha ofrecido mucho y lamentablemente no ha cumplido con lo que ha ofrecido.
The problem is that President Toledo promised a lot but never delivered. Back in 2000, my people from this community participated in a march which converged in Lima, demanding an end to Fujimori's rule. We had an illusion that Alejandro Toledo was very different, that he would change things. But now we know it's just the opposite. What Peruvians wanted was employment. That's the issue for every Peruvian.
Today, President Toledo has only 10% support in public opinion polls, the lowest of any head of state in Latin America. He lost popularity, in part, because he carried forward the globalization policies of his predecessor. Tight fiscal policies keep inflation low, but fail to produce enough jobs or alleviate poverty. Carlos Bruce, Minister of Housing and a top leader in Toledo's political party, defends the president's economic policies. The problem, says Minister Bruce, is that Toledo suffers from a general political cynicism among Peruvians.
There were some videotapes broadcasted where they show the congressmen, ministers, generals, politicians, everybody was receiving money from Mr. Montesinos, who was the principal advisor of President Fujimori. When that happens, the people just distrust all the political leaders, all the system.
Newspaper columnist and TV talk show host Mirko Lauer agrees that Peruvians are fed up with politicians, but they are especially angry at Toledo.
Most people you will talk to on these issues will say that Toledo made promises he could not keep. Yes, now you will tell me, how does this make him different from any other president or politician in the neighborhood? Somehow, Toledo's promises did come across differently because Toledo sold himself as a member of the great unwashed, as a member of the poor majorities and of the poor masses, which in racial and family and cultural terms, he was sometime in the remote past. So I think there is a lot of reproach in Mr. Toledo's low showings at the polls.
Toledo has joined leaders from Ecuador and Colombia in negotiating with the U.S. to create an Andean Free Trade Pact, similar to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Peru is still extremely underdeveloped compared to the U.S. or even neighboring Chile. Lauer says an economy like Peru's, which still relies on the export of minerals and a few other products, doesn't benefit from free trade agreement.
To have a commercial deal for a country like Peru that has no real commercial capacity is a bit ironic in the sense that the minerals we sell have been selling themselves for two centuries now, and that the other products, we are very small exporters, and that even if the idea of a trade pact was interesting and reasonable, it's very early in the day in the sense that people discuss agribusiness, for instance. Just 4 years ago, Peru started exporting grapes. This is very good. But I would say that before you make a deal related to exporting grapes, learn a bit more about exporting grapes, get a bit more grapes, a bit more experience, etc. From this point of view, Peru is not Chile.
Lauer notes that these agreements, while supposedly establishing free trade, in fact force developing countries to open their markets, while the U.S. continues to protect its agriculture and certain other industries. Even Canadian wheat farmers and cattle ranchers have a hard time exporting to the U.S. because of protectionism. So, asks Lauer, what chance does Peru have to export its agriculture? He also objects to the political and military components of the Andean Free Trade Pact, or TLC in Spanish.
My feeling is that the TLC follows a more political type of thing. I think that the TLC is interesting for the U.S. First, to keep the backyard in the fold. I think there's a genuine wish to sort of give something to the ones that can use it. And second, to create sort of a collective rule. It's no surprise that at the end of these negotiations, you always have the military clauses that come in, no? Do not sign the International Crime Pact, no cierto? Start dousing your drugs with Agent Orange or whatever. I think that all these small countries like Peru and Ecuador walk into this thinking they have been invited to a commercial party when they have really been invited to a political binge.
While the popular movements in Peru are not as strong as those in neighboring Bolivia, Lauer notes there is growing discontent with the policies of globalization.
There is a very strong, unmentioned leftist feeling among the people. I would say that from that point of view, the population of Peru is very modern. As we speak, this is a week in which many roads are being blocked, in which you have rocks all over the highways, in which people are mobilizing all over the country. They are mobilizing because they want better prices for the cotton crop. They are mobilizing because they want a better ecological deal from the mining operations. They are mobilizing because they want the decentralization.
And of course, they want basic services that serve ordinary people. For Making Contact, I'm Reese Ehrlich, reporting from Lima, Peru, and La Paz, Bolivia. That's it for this special edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Luis Gomez in La Paz for help in arranging interviews. Making Contact's theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 2005, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Justin Beck and Pauline Bartoloni, associate producers. Esther Manilla, office manager. Tom Evans, development associate. Peggy Law, founding director. Norman Solomon, senior advisor. David Barsamian, national advisor. And I'm your host, independent radio producer, Reese Ehrlich.